This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. The sandwich generation, it's made up of people who are generally between the ages of 45 and 65. On one side of the sandwich is that college graduate who came back home to live. On the other side are once aging parents, parents who need more help, even with daily tasks sometimes. We love them, and we approach their increased dependence in that spirit. We know it isn't always easy, psychologically, time-wise, and money-wise, but we can help you today. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard. The Cash Money Crew is here to help, for sure with the money part, and probably with some of the psychological barriers as well. Last month, we focused on our adult children. Today, we're going to focus more on our parents, their plan, and your role in that plan. Now, as I introduce our guest, I'm going to ask each one an opening question here. Alex Petrovic is a financial planner with Petrovic Financial Services. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back here.
Back. Thank you.
When is the time to start working on an estate plan?
Well, it's before the crisis hits, obviously. But that seems so obvious. But like many things that are so obvious, it's still delayed because there's a certain amount of anxiety to talk about estate planning.
Mm-hmm.
I think it makes people feel mortal, and as well as some decisions that are hard.
You say mournful, Alex?
Mortal.
Oh, mortal. I'm sorry.
Yeah, mournful maybe as well, but no, mortal. It's the reality that, I'm going to pass, and what's the process to get ready for that?
Yeah. Sandy Weaver is a CPA. Her company is Financial Security Advisors. Nice to have you back.
Nice to see you again, Bill.
What are some of the prices we pay for not creating an estate plan, sandwich generation or not?
Yes. Well, as regarding our parents, it's reacting in crisis mode. Instead of having a calm family discussion where all the siblings are involved and mom and dad are there and they give us an idea of how they'd like to pass through those later retirement years.
Also joining us in the studio for the first time, Corey Rasmussen. Corey is an elder law attorney. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Well, let's start here. Exactly how would you define your work? What is an elder law attorney?
Well, elder law is basically dealing with the elderly and trying to make sure that any kind of government benefits that might be out there are available to preserve as much of the assets as possible should a parent or somebody need additional care. And that care being the health care, maybe it's an in-home provider, maybe it's assisted living, maybe it's a skilled nursing facility, but trying to make sure that the assets are available for them, as well as being an advocate for your client when dealing with the nursing home administration and the fair hearings and things like that with the client. Because a lot of times when we get into this area, it's a big unknown, and so we try to assist in that process.
So what would be a major consequence of not developing a plan? Is it as simple as just there won't be enough money?
That is one of the biggest consequences, and money is a primary option, but the family distress is huge.
Okay.
Because if you run out of money, there are still needs that a parent requires, and trying to determine who's going to pay for those needs and make sure that mom and dad or whoever that person may be is adequately provided and given the highest quality of life possible, even if they are unfortunately disabled.
So how do you walk through that? How do you help people on that level? Is it just simply making sure that the estate plan is in order, or are there counseling services, or do you serve other roles for your clients?
Other roles, you call attorneys at law, and I would say I'm more of a counselor at law.
Okay.
In this area, we deal a lot more with the complete family dynamic, from mom and dad to the kids' spouses, and what those relationships are. Because when you're heading into this realm, as Alex was saying earlier, nobody wants to think about this because we're going to be immortal.
Right.
And having to, number one, step up and finally get an estate plan in place is a huge step. But that the parents do themselves. When we go to the next phase, we have to involve other people. And that's when the dynamics of the kids and how well they work together comes into play, as well as their spouses, as well as other circumstances that we may not be aware of. So when trying to do an estate plan, we have to get everything out in the open in order to make sure down the road the kids aren't going to sue each other and that all the planning we've done is for naught because nobody will agree on what is the proper outcome.
Yeah. Alex, what percentage of your clients have a plan in place?
Well, if they follow our instruction, they all do.
Okay.
But it is one of the hardest areas to get people to act on. I mean, they're much more likely to ask you what's the performance of their investment accounts than do you think my will is current or do you think I need a registration change for estate planning. So it's very hard. In fact, we had a client that we, you know, he said he had a problem. They were second marriages and they had one child that was at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so obvious candidates for estate planning. We ended up to get the deal done. Had an attorney from Kansas City fly to his town in Atlanta, and that got the deal done.
Okay.
So that's the procrastination. And he heads a corporation that one time was owned by Heinz. So it's not a matter of how smart they are or how wealthy they are. People just delay it. And Corey could probably be a better testimony to that, testimonial to that, that people just delay that part.
Sandy.
We've had a couple of cases. You know, this is something like Alex's firm where we bring it up tactfully year after year until it gets done. But mm-hmm. we've had some clients. They had moved to Arizona. They were second marriages, but they had been married themselves for, over 20 years. But it wasn't until another family situation happened and they saw somebody absconding with the money that they finally got to an attorney out there.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a trigger sometimes.
Right.
And honestly, that's a very good point, Sandy. Many times it is one of these things we don't want to deal with, and it's a triggering point.
Yeah.
Mom gets sick or a friend passes away suddenly, and they hear about all the problems that happened.
Right.
Now, in dealing with elder law, it's nice if the plan is put in place first. That gives us options down the road. But there has to be some sort of trigger point for them to get in and do it.
And then we're less likely to behave erratically or because of the emotions that we're feeling at that point in time. Makes perfect sense. I don't care who answers this question, but let me throw it out there. I'm going to assume that regardless of income and asset base, everyone should consider creating an estate plan. This is for everyone.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
There are different ways to do it. You can do it expensive. You can do it cheap.
Uh-huh.
Probably one of the best ways to do it, to get the best plan, is to go to an attorney such as Corey, who specializes in that area.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want someone who handles divorces. You don't want an attorney who does your farm lease. You know, you want an attorney who is up to date in this area. And they can do your powers of attorney for financial and health care decisions. You might be able to get by with a will only, or you might want a revocable trust. It might be better. And then also, you'll want to work with good insurance agents and consider long-term care, because that's mm-hmm. also part of the plan.
Okay. Corey, go ahead.
I think that we need to look at, for many people, they don't understand the consequences of not having an estate plan. You know, when is the proper time to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now. Mm-hmm. Because we have situations, many times people come in for the first time after they've had their first child purely to name a guardian. But we need to have powers of attorney.
Yeah.
Like Sandy has said, because if you don't have a power of attorney and something happens to you, you have to go to court to get that person appointed, and that can be expensive.
So it will automatically go to probate court?
Probate court, but it's not a probate, per se, probate. It's a proceeding of having the judge appoint who the person is to take care of that incapacitated individual's affairs for both health care and financial decisions.
Yeah.
And that puts a delay in the system.
I've had clients that actually will say, listen, they're going to get the money. It's their problem. Okay? And I don't know how you respond to that except to say, well, if you have a respect for your beneficiaries, it makes life a lot easier for them
mm-hmm.
as well as it makes it less, stressful and for those beneficiaries. But we have had clients that say, you know what, I don't want to go. I'm not going to spend the money. I'm not going to do all that. They can deal with it when I pass. They'll have the money to deal with it.
But you can still do an inexpensive plan if you use blueprint documents from such as uslegalzoom.com. Those are pretty simple. You read those, check the box, sign in front of a notary. Midwest Bioethics has a free power of attorney for
great resource.
Yeah.
And the Kansas City Bar has powers of attorney and healthcare docs too.
Yeah.
But you still can't make them sign it. You can't make, they have to be willing. I mean, you must have had people that have said, hey, it's not my problem. I don't know, maybe not. Maybe I had the wrong client.
That just means it goes on next year's agenda.
Yeah, you make a note of that. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, KCUR. We're streaming on KCUR.org. I'm Bill Anderson. Our guest, Corey Rasmussen, he's an estate planning attorney, an elder attorney. Sandy Weaver is here from Financial Security Advisors. And so is Alex Petrovic, financial planner. He's with Petrovic Financial Services. So mom and dad are aging. It's time to create a plan to cover health, wealth, and final wishes. Have you helped your mom and dad? Maybe mom and dad have moved in. Talk about your experience. How is that going? Call 816-235-2888. The number again, 816-235-2888. You can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So, Corey, where do we begin? I've decided I need a plan, and I've contacted you. We're sitting in your office. What's the first thing you say to me? What do we look at?
Well, the first thing that we look at is the family dynamics to see who are the people that we can rely upon.
Mm-hmm.
Because our number one with a married couple, the parent or the spouse will be the primary fiduciary, which is the one that would make decisions. But on the second stage, which child, is there a child that would be the best to make the decisions, both for financial and health care? And then also, do we need to look at doing a will, a beneficiary designation, which would then again avoid probate, or do we do a trust? And that is all determinant on the assets that the client has and what their needs are.
Okay.
But the first step is to find out where we are as a family and what our goals are.
Okay. And obviously the first goal is to make sure there's enough money to take care of mom and dad while they're living. But
yes.
Then I guess the secondary is to maybe have some assets left over to be shared among the siblings.
That is definitely a goal.
Yeah.
And one of the things we have to address in our meetings as we progress is long-term care insurance.
Yeah.
And I think that's hopefully one of the topics we're going to talk about today, because that's a way to offset the nursing home costs should we need it.
Well, let's talk about it now, because there are all kinds of policies that are offered people at any number of, you know, prices. How do we go about shopping for the one that's most appropriate for us?
We like to see our clients tackle that piece of it early in their late 50s to get quotes from various sources. Another thing that's important in that area is to make sure there's some compounding of benefits for inflation, because those expenses rise usually higher than your normal inflation rate.
Okay.
And then there are different elimination periods for some. For clients, we also check how much they can insure on their own. If you have a $2 million portfolio, you can afford to finance some of that yourself. If you have a $50,000 portfolio of investments, you're not going to be able to do that. So
mm-hmm.
that matters too. But there are different things to take a look at. But you want to get it earlier rather than later, because it can get really expensive later.
Corey. Yeah.
And one of the points on that is with the long-term care insurance, it's really important to bring in a financial planner that can take a look at your entire picture. Sandy's absolutely right to look at it prior to 60, because the premiums are typically less. And I am not by any means an expert in long-term care insurance.
Uh-huh.
I've just dealt with it.
Yes.
But we also need to look at what does the picture look like when we're 75 and we're 80 and we're on fixed income. Can we still afford those premiums? And that's where a financial advisor can say, you know, today you might be able to afford X amount, but when you're 75 and you're living on Social Security, you're not going to be able to afford this. So let's make sure we fit the right policy with where you're going to be in the future.
Yeah. Alex.
Well, we need a whole show on this. I mean, it'd be a great show. There's just so many different dynamics. One of the recent dynamics is now they're going to underwrite men and women differently, and women's rates are going to be dramatically higher because they live longer and they end up collecting, I think, 2/3 of the benefits. But you don't have to insure the whole assisted living, the whole long-term care. I mean, you can buy just pieces of it, you know, so you're only buying – let's say if in Missouri it's $50,000 for being in a facility, maybe you only underwrite half of it. So you offset some of those expenses going forward. But this is big. And low interest rates, I mean, we, again, are killing long-term care insurance companies, because that's really a big part of how they fund their benefits through interest rate. And the rates are so low, what's happened instead is they have to charge more premiums because they can't get a bang for their buck on the conservative investments. So
right.
It'd be a great show. Love to do it.
So what you're saying is this long-term care insurance plan that I have in place, it's just there to complement the savings that I have and Social Security check that I may be receiving and that
yes.
sort of thing, if things have gone well
yes.
over the course of my working life?
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems, though, is people that need it the most can't afford it.
Yeah.
Because there are, you know, so it's much like any like health insurance, but the people that have the most money usually have it.
Uh-huh.
And then it's the person in the middle that has a decent amount of money, but it's hard for them to decide. It's not black and white.
Right.
So you can run numbers, scenarios of different times that you might need that long-term care
uh-huh.
in your financial plan to see, you know, where the stress is on the plan. But the people in the middle are the hardest because they have some funds to do it, but it's not clear that they're going to reap the benefits from it to spend that money.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard to pull the trigger. And I've looked at some of those policies, and they're kind of
$2,000 a year, yeah.
Yeah, and they're confusing, too.
Oh, yes, yes. But on the other hand, when you run a retirement projection for somebody, you know, insuring your risk is more important than the next cruise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's important to keep priorities in place. You know, it's the way it goes.
But the other thing on that, too, it's not one size fits all. There are a ton of long-term care insurance products out there. There's a program in Kansas, and I believe it's in Missouri now, which is called a partnership program, which is to incentivize people to buy long-term care insurance.
Okay.
And so that allows for you to preserve more assets.
How does that work?
To encourage people to buy long-term care insurance, if you buy, let's say, a total coverage of $150,000 and you need to be in a nursing home and you utilize all of that, when you have to go to apply for Medicaid, instead of being, for example, in Kansas, it's $2,000, or Missouri, it's $999.
Mm-hmm.
They add back that $150,000 that you've already paid. So now you've preserved $152,000 or $151,000.
Yeah.
And that's where the partnership works out well, because if we can't afford the huge policy to protect all of our assets, at least we can save a portion, and we know that we have that amount of money left for a surviving spouse, potentially, or for any other situations that may arise. And that's one of the big benefits of the partnership program. Now, a financial advisor is the one that's going to know if the policy qualifies or not, because some of them do not qualify.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate, Alex, for just a second. Let's say I have a big, fat term insurance policy. Life insurance policy. Let's say it's $250,000. I'm just pulling these numbers out of the air. Why would I be interested in long-term care?
Well, because you have to die to collect it. So
yeah.
What we're insuring is, obviously, is living too long, not living your money.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Yeah. So yeah. The life insurance isn't going to do – although there are some policies that have a long-term care rider on them that are important. But one of the problems is, that just to add to Corey, is because of this low interest rate environment, insurance companies are really in a pinch. A lot of companies are getting out of that business right now,
mm-hmm.
so there are less people writing that business, quality companies. And what they've also found is people are living longer, and the lapse rate is less than what the experience was. So they're finding it not to be as profitable as usual. So there's a real crunch in here in terms of who can get it and how much they got to pay for it.
235-2888 is the phone number to reach the studios of KCUR. It's Central Standard, and I'm Bill Anderson. And let's go to the phone lines. I believe we've got a caller on line 4. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm a registered nurse, and I've worked in home care for over 35 years. But when my father-in-law came to live with us, my husband's an only child, he moved from New York to Kansas to be with us. And he had Parkinson's, but besides that, he was basically very healthy. He needed some personal care help, and he did not want a family member helping him. So we went through quite a few agencies and quite a few people because, as I think most people would be, he was very particular about having someone help him with personal care and dressing and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried going through an agency as well as hiring privately, and we had all the the bad things happened to us when we went privately. We had somebody who didn't show up frequently, and we had to replace them. We had some money missing. But when we went through an agency, and that's my message today, is it cost a little bit more on an hourly rate, but they were bonded, and they'd also send somebody else if there was someone that was ill. So it was very helpful to keeping him with us. And he lived to be 92 and stayed with us for 7 years, and he was actually a very important part of my children's lives as they were getting into junior high and high school.
Judy, that's very good to hear you talking about the positive aspects of a parent coming to reside with you know, a child. And we often kind of overlook, and I think sometimes we focus a little too much on the negative side of that.
He was pretty set in his ways because he and his wife had lived in an apartment in New York City all their lives and raised only one child, so it was a big adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
But another good part of that is my father-in-law was very particular about his what he ate, and my husband became a great cook because he knew what my father-in-law would eat, so he ended up taking over the kitchen and cooking for all of us.
That's great. Well, thanks.
It was a good experience for the most part for all of us.
Uh-huh. Well, thanks for phoning in, Judy.
Thank you.
And John's joining us from Kansas City. You're on the air, John.
Yes, I just wanted to make one comment about this. In terms of Social Security, Social Security Administration doesn't recognize power of attorneys. So if somebody has a check coming from Social Security, whether it be an older person or a child who is a survivor, the individual who's going to take over the responsibilities has to come into the office with the proof that the person needs a payee, and then they'll determine whether or not the person is qualified and is going to have interest in the person. And then we require a yearly analysis where they have to fill out paperwork and tell us what they've done with the money. But we don't accept power of attorney, so you can't just take over a bank account and start taking and doing the Social Security part of it, because if you do, you can be charged with misuse. So you do have to come in and get approved to be a payee.
Hey, John, if I can ask you a question, do you work for Social Security?
Yes.
I know that it can be a problem for clients in becoming the representative payee, which is what you're talking about.
Yes.
When we have a parent that's had a stroke.
Right.
And we can't bring them into your office for the power of attorney.
You get a doctor's statement saying that the person can't handle their affairs because of a stroke or something like that. And then the person who wants to come in to be the payee has to, you know, maybe if they're a relative or whatever they are, the relationship is, they have to show an interest in the person and that we feel comfortable with making that person the payee.
Mm-hmm. I'll bet you've got some pretty good stories, John.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not terrible to, you know, to get to become a payee. If you know, like if it's the husband who's had the stroke, then the wife comes in, we're going to probably, you know, go along and approve her, okay? Now, if she comes in and acts like she doesn't really care, you know, then we may look for an institution or something else.
Thanks for calling in this morning.
Sure enough.
Take care, John. Michael's joining us from Overland Park. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
We're doing well.
Good. Yeah, hey, I just wanted to bring up the point. I know estate planning is often brought up when we have aging parents. I kind of have a unique perspective here. I was a pastor for 7 years, did a number of funerals for people who died before they should have. Recently, about 4 years ago, became a financial advisor just to take control of my schedule a little bit more. So I see it from both perspectives, and there's the conversation of estate planning and what would happen in the event of your passing those assets on your kids. What we got to remember is if I'm a 21-year-old, my parents die, or my single parent passes, I'm an adult, and suddenly I'm given IRA accounts, 401k assets. If there's not a trust in place, I don't know if I would have made smart decisions at that age with that that big amount of money. So we got to keep in mind, if you've got people to pass money to, it doesn't matter when your age is, what your age is. I think people need to make sure that they have a clear understanding of how those assets would be handled at whatever age when those assets are passed on to their kids. And when they're minors, that's another story. But you know, it just kind of clears up the questions to make sure something's in place before parents reach those late 70s, 80s, 90s. You know, if you're a parent, you know, it's worth having the question, if we died in a car crash, where would these assets go to? How would my kids handle them? Can we put some structure in place for them?
Sandy, Michael makes a very good point.
Yes, and we go through that with our folks, too. Lots of times, if your children are minors, you want to, you know, have custodians lined up in your legal documents. But also, let's say they are in their 20s. And what often sometimes is a case is you might have two children that are pretty responsible, but a third is not. And one of the nice things you can do with a trust, you could do it in a will too, but a trust is probably avoids probate and is easier, but you can have that those funds for that one child held in trust for them and have an independent trustee make sure that that money doesn't get spent on a beach in Hawaii in 1 year. You know, and as a parent, that's what you want. You want that money there to put a roof over their heads if they ever need it, but you don't want it there to party in 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Alex?
Oh, I agree. I think those are great points in terms of how you delegate, you know, your legacy. But kind of getting back to the sandwich generation, really, though, I think one of the things that we talked about, you know, previously was that really the burden it puts on women, because they're traditionally the caregivers. And
they tend to outlive us.
And they tend to outlive us. Mm-hmm. And the problem is too is that
darn
women
you
get
women.
exactly. That's another topic. But they tend to get married later. That means they have their kids later too. That means that the sandwich is even bigger with them. And
right.
In so many cases, people that really are don't have all the financial assets necessary and as caregivers, is that then they give up maybe work or benefits and that, and then they repeat the cycle and that they're not prepared for retirement as well.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple things to add about that, if I could.
Feel free.
Quickly. According to MetLife studies, 66% of caregivers are women. 30% of caregivers do it for over 5 years. A little less than half of caregivers lose their job because of it.
Really?
Yes. So.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Well, maybe we should talk about that when we return. We're going to take a break. We'll talk about what Sandy's brought to the table here. We'll talk about taxes. We'll talk about Medicare, Medicaid planning even. It's Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. You're listening to it on KCUR and KCUR.org. I'm Bill Anderson. Welcome to Central Standard on 89.3 FM. Today we're talking about members of the sandwich generation. On one end, you may have adult kids back in the house. On the other end, mom and dad may be living with you. They're aging anyway, and they are going to need some help. And our focus today is on the parents of the sandwich generation. Financial planners Sandy Weaver and Alex Petrovic are here to take your phone call, and so is estate planning attorney, elder attorney Corey Rasmussen. Our phone number, 235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Sandy, just before the break, you were talking about a pretty alarming statistic of people losing their jobs.
Yes.
The result of being providing for a parent, an aging parent in the home.
Right, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's staggering. It was like 30%, right?
Well, it's fewer than half of the workers managed to keep their jobs.
Yeah, fewer than half.
And that was in
half.
Forbes last month.
Yeah. And Corey, another negative, you know, I would guess that the divorce rate spikes as well because of the stress that puts on the family dynamic.
It really does. I don't have numbers for the divorce rate, but
right.
just the overall stress with the marital unit.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we try to do is, for example, if your mom or somebody coming in has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, we have a great association, the Alzheimer's Association here in Kansas City, to get into a support group. to try to help mitigate that stress.
Right.
And Alex brought up a point over the break about, here I have mom in my home and I'm taking care of her. My brother, who's in Houston, doesn't know the day-to-day activities and doesn't understand why we spend the money we do. And since they're not there, they can't see the needs, and they may even be in denial.
Mm-hmm.
And his sister-in-law may be of the same opinion of, we could move her down to Houston and take care of her, but they don't, without being there day-to-day, they don't understand it, nor do they understand that it's a huge move when somebody is in Alzheimer's or needs care to move that care to a different place with different providers. Mm-hmm. And I think Alex has dealt with that many times.
Yeah, well, personally, one of the things that, if you can, if you can keep the parent where they have support, which is their family, and maybe they have siblings as well that are still living, but that's a very helpful number. But if you do have an out-of-town sibling, one possibility is to give them a specific responsibility, like in this case, pay all the bills. And these days, it's pretty easy to do online. So that person at least has that responsibility that they can contribute, which is meaningful, to be sure all of mom or dad's bills are taken care of.
Yeah.
And then the local people can be the ones that take them to the dentist, the doctor, and that sort of thing. So you can spread out the duties. But one of the other problems, really shortly, is families are smaller. So in the old days, my mom and dad were 1 of 10. I was 1 of 6. And now mine are 2 of 2.
Yeah. In case my son's listening, I want Elizabeth to take care of me, son. nothing against you, but... getting back on a serious track, though, my dad was really proactive in planning for the end-of-life issues and making sure that he had enough money to live and trying to provide for... We have a disabled member of our family and trying to make sure that she was taken care of also. But I will tell you, it was... And I may have shared this with you before. It was so difficult to accept that my dad was approaching me to take over his responsibilities. Here was this huge, bigger than life figure, that raised me, and the person who took care of all the financial matters, all the budgeting, all those matters in our household. Corey,
it's a very huge step, and one of the big ones is when you have to take away the car, because that's the meaning of independence.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, his parents decline, they have to rely on other people. So taking away the vehicle, while it's a public safety issue, we need to do it for that. And then when we take away the control over financial assets, one of the ways to try to help that as our parents age is to go with your parents or the children or whomever the trusted person is, to go with the parents to start developing a relationship with whomever their financial advisor is, so that when the time comes, if it comes, it's a much more natural transition. Everybody on board understands what our goals are, and they understand the relationships involved. So maybe we can take away that pain that our parents have when we say, hey, mom, dad, you just can't pay your bills anymore. And we have Nigeria trying to get taxes from you every day and paying, because we've had people do that before.
Mm-hmm. We've had, the last couple of years, some experiences where the middle-aged adult children have brought in their parents and had their parents interview us and hire us, because dad has, like your dad, always taken care of the finances and paying the bills and handling the investments. And so they put us in place, and we work with the elder parents. We're also in a better position to figure out, do you have money to gift now? And that removes that middle-aged child from that conflict of interest.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Corey.
And Sandy, you're nailing it on the head there, where we typically will have one family member that takes care of most of the finances. And then if we had a sudden illness or a decline, the other spouse is completely helpless and clueless and scared. They've never been in that position. And that's where having some support system in place is so important, so that she's already dealing with the loss of her spouse, or he is. But now at least we know the money's taken care of and we don't have that concern. And we've also mitigated predators from coming in to try to get a hold of that money.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, and they're out there. Oh, gosh, I remember people trying to take advantage of my dad as he was losing his capacity to make rational decisions. It was horrifying, and it was it always made me incredibly angry. If I could have gotten to those people, who knows what would have taken place. Hey, Gloria's joining us from Kansas City, Missouri. Gloria, are you with us?
I am. I did revocable living trust through a company. And so I have my portfolio and my car. I no longer have a house, but everything is in the name of the trust. I realized later that I co-own a timeshare and own another timeshare, which is, those are in my name. And will that jeopardize my living trust? What's your advice on that?
Sandy?
We have clients with those, and we've checked into them in that estate planning process. Sometimes you'll have to talk with the people who are administering the timeshare. Sometimes your timeshare units, you know, become zip, zero at your death. So you don't have to worry what happens after that. Sometimes, though, you're allowed to pass on those timeshare units. And if that's the case, you want to see if you can get a transfer on death, perhaps, over into your trust. Check with your attorney to make sure that's what you want to do. But it depends what kind of timeshare units you have. So I would start there first, calling up, you know, the operators of the timeshare.
Counselor?
On the timeshares, there's a couple ways to handle those. They're typically not here in Kansas or Missouri, so let's say it's in Florida. If
right.
you don't do anything with it and you pass away and you want to preserve that, you're going to have to go through probate in Florida to change title. And that can be a pretty huge yeah. dilemma, especially if the timeshare is not worth as much as what you paid for it. So what we do is a timeshare is typically either done through a contract or a deed. Many times, uh-huh. most of them are contracts. And we'll work with the timeshare company, bring in an attorney in the state where we're at, call it Florida, Hawaii, wherever the case may be, to go ahead and transfer that into the trust, or, as Sandy said, do a beneficiary designation to transfer into the trust upon your passing. And that will accomplish the goal of avoiding probate. Now, some of the timeshares are underwater, and they're very difficult to get rid of at this point in time. And you mm-hmm. may not want that to pass on to the next generation. And therefore, if it is one that you don't want and you've been trying to get out of it, leave it in your name. And then upon your passing, essentially, it will pass away.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And speaking of probate, I believe Mary has a question from Gladstone.
Good morning. I am the personal representative for my aunt's estate. She had her will and everything set up, but she still wanted everything to go through probate. She entered the nursing home last fall, and at that time, she put me on her checking account and several CDs so that I could take care of her expenses. Now that she's passed, we're starting the process for probate, and my question is, to whom do those funds belong to that are in the checking and CD accounts?
Well, the first thing is that I want to make sure everybody's aware of is a will by definition causes probate. So you can't avoid probate because you have a will. A will speaks as to your intentions after you pass away. So every will probably be probated.
Okay.
As to the accounts that you have, is your name on them or are you a signatory?
I'm on them.
Then you are the legal owner of them. Many people try to do that for the ease, like your aunt did, mm-hmm. and they don't understand that upon their passing, that individual now owns that asset and has no requirements to distribute it to anybody else. So if you're on there, you are the owner.
So is it just a moral dilemma at this point, if I know what her intentions were?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right.
Well, good luck with that, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hopefully we were helpful. Betty's calling from Kansas City, but before we take Betty's call, Sandy, you had something to add.
I did. We usually advise against that, you know, putting, you know, a child or, you know, a niece on a bank account or a CD simply because of asset protection or liability purposes. You know, because if the woman who just called in had an accident and been successfully sued against, they could go and attach that CD, that bank account, for her, mm-hmm. for her problems, you know. And usually you want to do, as Corey suggested, just be the signatory if the bank will let you do it.
Okay. Yeah. You're nodding your head yes, Corey.
That, to try to avoid probate, many people have heard, go ahead and put your kids on as joint tenants on your home on the different accounts. And if they were to get divorced, potentially they could come after those assets. And the other thing is they're an owner just like you. They can take all the money out of it if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. So a signatory is much better than putting them on as an owner.
We're fortunate to live in Missouri and Kansas because they allow a transfer on death on real estate. Not all states do.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM. We're streaming at kcur.org. I'm Bill Anderson. Our guest, Corey Rasmussen, he's an elder attorney, an estate planning attorney. Sandy Weaver of Financial Security Advisors is here. And so is Alex Petrovic, financial planner and the owner of Petrovic Financial Services. And we are talking about the sandwich generation and estate planning. Do you have any questions? If you do, phone right now. We've got a few minutes left in the hour, and we'd like to take your call at 235-2888. That's 235-2888. Alex.
Well, one of the dynamics that's shifted in our profession is, in the old days, and certainly still, and meeting with a new client, for example, the question was, do you have an anticipated inheritance? And that's still a question we ask. But in today's terms, we add to that with, and I'll quote, do you feel a moral or financial responsibility to any senior member of your family, aunts and uncles, cousins, or whatever, which is there a liability that you may have to face, mm-hmm. that you want to face, or that you will have to face? So as part of the fact-finding, when we meet with the baby boomers, in this case probably, or that sandwich generation, so asking them up front, and sometimes they've never really thought of it as part of the planning process. So it starts the conversation.
That's a good point.
235-2888. That's the number that Jake phoned in on. You're on the air, Jake.
Yeah, good morning, folks. We asked for the tap to be turned off, and it's turned off. And just a question, how do you all advise families that attempt to divest their elders of every asset they've got as quickly as they can before their demise or before they become incapacitated in order to make them wards of the state and avoid, you know, using the asset base those individuals have that would normally be used to pay for those expenses, and they lay it off on the taxpayers?
Jake, you bring up a very interesting point. There are people that do that or attempt to do that to where they know they have to go into a nursing home, and so they give away all their assets to the kids, and I think that's what you're talking about, isn't it, Jake?
Yes, and I'm curious as to whether the ethical aspect of it ever enters anybody's mind in your profession. I mean, you know, I mean, it's legal. There are paths to take legally. But there's some ethical questions, I think, that need to be addressed.
Well, let's address the legal issue first, because that's where you can actually go to jail. And the legal side of it is, if you do that and you apply for Medicaid, you have to disclose all those transfers if it's been done 5 years prior to the application date. And if you don't disclose those transfers, you're guilty of Medicaid fraud. And that's a pretty severe penalty out there. The other one is, if you've done it without the person's knowledge or without their consent, and you're not using that to their best interest, Missouri just passed a criminal statute on that for financial elder abuse. So from a legal standpoint, that does not work anymore. From an ethical standpoint, you raise some pretty good issues of, you know, is it the responsibility of the individual to pay their own share, or do you do planning to get them on Medicaid and preserve as much of the assets as possible? And that's really a fine line that you have to evaluate myself as a elder law attorney to determine what are we trying to accomplish here. Now, one of the fears that we have is that mom or dad does run out of all the money and they don't have enough just to even be able to get to take haircuts, to get new clothes, the things that aren't covered by Medicaid. So many times you want to plan so that we have at least some of mom or dad's assets available to take care of those needs, so that the kids don't have to figure out a way to do it, because many of the kids may not be financially able to do it themselves.
You know, let's transition into taxes. You know, if mom and dad do run out of money and they move in with me, I'm going to derive some benefits right?
Yes,
from
you
a tax standpoint and a credit standpoint?
Yes, you will, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that.
Well, there's a few that can help out. You might be able to claim them as a dependent. Let's see.
Did not know that.
Yes, you can. If you pay more than half of their support, and if they earn less than $3,800 a year. You might also, if you're single and helping mom or dad, let me back up. Mom or dad does not necessarily have to live with you in order to claim them as a dependent. Then if you're single, you might be able to file as head of household. And if you're middle or upper income, that's a big deal because it will keep you in the 25% bracket far higher income levels.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you're single making $88,000, you can make up to $125,000 and still pay 25% tax bracket. So that's a big deal to have head of household. And again, your parent doesn't necessarily have to live with you.
Yeah, that kind of surprises me, Corey, that I can derive benefit without mom and dad being in the same house.
From the tax standpoint, yeah.
Yeah.
Because even though it's just like a child off to college, they're still your dependent. Same type of situation. Or if you're providing for a child at, you know, for the younger, which we're normally thinking of dependents as being children,
yeah,
we have the same characteristics. It's just now we're looking at an older person,
yeah,
where we're providing all their support.
What are some of the other tax benefits or credits that I may be overlooking that I could take advantage of as I help mom and dad transition and as they go through the aging process?
If you help pay for their mortgage so they can remain in their home, you can deduct that for them if they're a dependent.
Okay.
You can also, if you're perhaps might be able to get a medical expense deduction, it has to be over 10% of your income level.
Okay.
That's new this year. It used to be 7.5. But again, if you're helping them with drugs, if you're taking them to and from the doctor, you know, that's 24% per mile. You can help deduct through that section there.
Is anyone able to explain the dependent care credit? Corey, maybe that's a question for you.
I think that's a Sandy question.
That's a Sandy question?
Yeah, you can get up to $1,050 tax credit, dollar for dollar reduction of your final tax bill. If you're working or looking for work, it's 35% of the first $3,000 you spend.
Okay.
Providing care.
Today on Marketplace Morning Report, they talked about a lawsuit against a group of insurance companies, and it was regarding annuity payouts. And essentially, the insurance companies were active in stopping payments to people who passed away, you know, so that they didn't have to make a payout, but not so aggressive in identifying people who passed away and had beneficiary payments that would be paid out. I guess this brings two points to the table here. A, I don't want to say don't trust anyone, but be very mindful and be very active with whomever you're working with on the financial plan for your parents and for your own estate. And I'd like you to react to that first. Sandy, you're kind of nodding your head, so I'm going to pick on you.
Okay, a couple thoughts.
Yeah.
When you're getting quotes for insurance, the cheapest isn't necessarily the best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you want to deal with reputable insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is when you decide who to put in your will or your trust as your personal representative, you know, that's a responsibility. There are things they need to file that death certificate and make sure that, you know, funds are handed over from life insurance companies, and that's not easy. They'll open an account, and you have to write a check to get it out these days. But,
right,
you know, someone who's on top of things and doesn't let things slide.
And I think we have an obligation, if we're a beneficiary of someone's life insurance policy or some sort of a policy, that needs to be made known, right? I mean,
yes,
it's as simple as that.
Oftentimes, parents are reluctant to disclose that, but at least encourage them to have a place where that information is kept, so that the siblings that they're passing or incapacitation know where to get that information.
And one of the problems that we have is trying to find all the assets. So we need to sit down and have an inventory of what assets do we have, where are they, who's on it, who owns it, is it joint, trust, individuals, and the safe deposit box, everything that we have, because it's very difficult after somebody passes away to go back and you're basically playing detective to try to find everything. One of the big ones that we have issues with when somebody passes is a whole life policy that's been paid up,
right,
meaning you don't owe premiums because those are very tough to find.
Okay, yeah.
And an inventory asset listing is much helpful.
Quickly, what's the benefit of avoiding probate? Is it just time and money? It's less costly to avoid it?
Yes.
Okay.
The answer is
time,
yes,
money, and exposure,
okay,
to some people.
Oh, yeah, because that's a public document, right?
It is. Everything that happens in the probate court,
yeah,
is a matter of public record, and anybody can get it. So you can see the assets they have and where they're going to.
I want to talk to David real quick. Like, David, you're on the air with us.
Yes, I just wanted to pass on a comment of what I'm going through in the matter of you need to, when you have a child with special needs, like autism, you need to start planning for you and them as early as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 76. My son's 38.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us this morning, David. And Corey, of course, you agree.
David, you bring up a huge point because your question, I'm sure, is who's going to take care of your autistic child after you pass away? Is that correct? I don't think David's on there anymore, but
here he is. Hi, David.
Is that one of your primary concerns, is who's going to take care of your child?
Yes, that's part of what I've been dealing with. I'm the only one in my family that's left. Everybody else has died.
And it's also, it's sometimes that's a burden to put on them, even a brother or a sister. So one of the things is, especially in Missouri and there's other places, there's a group called the Truman Neurological Center Communities, or TNC, and they provide homes for disabled children that then become adults, where they're not in an institution like a nursing home, but they're in an actual home in a neighborhood where they can actually be taken care of, and they don't feel like they're in an institution, and Medicaid will pick that up.
Corey, thanks for being here this morning. Corey Rasmussen with the Rasmussen Law Firm. Your advice was well received.
Thank you, Bill.
And Sandy, good to see you again.
Same here.
Sandy Weaver of Financial Security Advisors. Alex, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Bill.
Alex with Petrovic Financial Services. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of the archived shows at the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Claire McInerney, Ross Steinmetz, and Sangeeta Shastri. I'm Bill Anderson. It's always a privilege to sit in the host chair. This is KCUR.